The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I've been doing this practice for 20 years or so, and it's wonderful to see how this center has grown with Gil. I have two activities that I value highly outside of the center. I am very active in building a monastery in Mendocino County called Abhayagiri, which is in the Theravadan tradition. You may have heard of some of the monks there, Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Pasano. Their main teacher was Ajahn Sumedho, and his was Ajahn Chah. So it's that Thai forest tradition. That monastery started in 1996. You're all welcome to come and visit. It's about a three-hour drive from here, up 101. And then for about 5 years, I and three or four more people from this center and altogether about a dozen people from this center and the Santa Cruz Vipassana Center go to Soledad Prison and teach Buddhist meditation to long-term inmates. That turns out to be a very rewarding activity. If there's anybody that suffers more in this life than the people in this room, including myself, it's people living in prison. What I'd like to do tonight is, and the purpose of having read those basic instructions, is to pose the following question. The Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. That's all I teach. He also said, used a phrase which I like a lot, that this practice is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. Now, I think it's easy for all of us to imagine that what he means by beautiful in the end is that you are enlightened, and that's pretty obvious. Nobody has to explain that that's beautiful. You sort of know that, even if you don't know anything about enlightenment. That's got to be good. But how about beautiful in the beginning, when I'm sitting here and I can't keep my mind on my breath for more than half a second at a time? My mind is besieged by all kinds of afflictive emotions and thoughts. And I'm full of opinions and aversion and greed and delusion. How can that be beautiful? And how in the world could that have anything to do with suffering and the end of suffering? So that's what I'd like to try to address tonight by bringing our attention to this practice in its essence of the instructions I just read. And so what I'd like to do is encourage you all to offer anything that you've learned, any development that's happened as a result in yourself of just sitting down here and doing these things, sitting erect, quieting the mind, attempting to quiet the mind, beg your pardon, bringing your attention to your breath, perhaps then to whatever other dominant experience arises, trying to maintain a point of view, if you like, of the mind which is open and receptive and interested in investigating whatever the experience that is arising, be it bodily sensations, emotions, thoughts, anything, and doing that in a form of a practice, just as simple as going out every Saturday morning and throwing a baseball to learn how to play baseball. What are the skills? And I want you to think very basic here. We're not talking about enlightenment here. We're talking about what, as you begin to throw the mental baseball, what are the skills that begin to be developed? What do you find out about yourself? What does your mind learn how to do? I'm trying to give you the flavor of my question. I'll give an example. To me, the very act of sitting down and deciding I'm going to meditate practices intention. It practices actually consciously having an intention and then acting on that intention, following through on that intention. Every time I sit down, every time I find myself lost in thought and come back to the breath, intention, following through on intention. So that's the kind of thing I'm trying to tease out of you here. Anybody have anything to offer that they've seen at this basic level?
I'll bite. So this practice is a kind of a slow bake process. At least for me, things don't happen overnight and take some time. But what I've noticed in the ability to still the mind and calm the mind and watch the mind and watch the sensations as they come and go, a real interesting benefit came about. I used to be, in certain circumstances, highly claustrophobic, panic, fear, just gripping. And the other day I had to go through a series of MRIs that lasted over an hour, and normally that would I would need to be sedated or something. But in the process, one, I could see the wellspring of panic just sort of start arising, but it never took hold because I could just see it happen and see the body sensations, and there was space involved with it. Sometimes Gill says the sort of the difference between those who meditate and those who don't meditate is the difference between being in a crowded elevator with a bunch of sweaty 300-pound people in a very small, cramped space. But if you sort of meditate, I'm paraphrasing horribly, it's as if you're in a cathedral and the same amount of people are there, but you're way across the other side, and it's you, a tremendous amount of space. So in a way, it actually is that way. You have a lot more, in a way, to work with, the ability to see things as they arise, note them, and not be overwhelmed. And it obviously goes from on a day-to-day basis, too.
So if I could paraphrase you, please correct me if I'm wrong. First of all, you warmed up by mentioning half a dozen skills that you developed before you even got to that, which were something about quieting the mind, noticing what was arising. which to me means that you've developed a kind of observer mind quality where you have this observer mind that can watch that out of control part of the mind do its thing and right. know that that's what's happening.
That's something actually that Andrea stresses. Andrea Fellow, one of the teachers here, she has on occasion a householder's retreat, which individuals can go in the morning and then in the evening on a daily basis for a week. And what you do is you practice noting and being aware of everyday mundane things. So things that you do over and over during the day. You get up, you put something in your mouth to eat, any activity, go through a passageway door, etc. And you learn to note that you're doing that as you're doing that. And it takes a long time because, let's say you pick putting on your shoes. Usually when you start out, you put on your shoes and you forget about being aware of putting on your shoes until you're halfway down the block. But slowly, the space between doing it and being aware that you're doing it gets closer and closer together, so you're actually, oh, I'm now putting on my shoes. And that then can carry on to other things. And it nicely informs one's meditation because then one notes, oh, I'm off in the weeds now. So practice kind of folds on each other and sort of reinforces different things.
You also, at the outset, mentioned the idea that this is slow, in which I hear the word patience.
Yeah, I think you need patience. You don't have to have patience, but it helps.
Anyone here doing okay without patience in this practice? I think it's perhaps requisite to come back and do it at least one more time.
I think you eventually succumb to patience.
Succumb to patience.
You have no choice.
Anybody else? Victor?
The talk of patience brought to mind something maybe perhaps a little bit related. It's almost, I think, a survival reflex for meditation, and that is compassion.
Compassion.
I think compassion is very necessary.
Compassion towards yourself, do you mean?
Yes, during the meditation process. Because things arise. And compassion, I think, is a very important thing to have, both with the actual process of meditation, the coming back over and over again, and also with the things that arise as well.
So when difficult things arise, the compassion to create enough space to work with it without freaking out, the self-forgiveness, that kind of quality in your relationship to yourself?
Yes, I would say so.
And so are you meaning to say that you find that as you sit that this quality of compassion develops? It isn't just what you started with, but becomes more?
I think what I've found is that it's in two pieces. One, you cultivate a quality of compassion to make the meditation process easier and to nurture it. And then two, as you investigate and things unfold, when they release, there's a natural sense of compassion that's there already that becomes evident. It's always been there, just you realize it's there afterwards.
So in some ways it's more perhaps a matter of becoming aware of something that was there. And in the awareness of it, the greater utilization of it. Hard to say whether it's actually growing or your ability to use it is simply growing. Kind of like throwing a baseball. Do you actually create a whole new arm, or do you just create an arm that knows how to use itself?
Well, I think the idea of intention, you can bring that to your seat with you, and then you realize it's unfolding. But I think it does help to bring the intention with you to the seat. At least it has for me.
Anyone else? Yeah.
Is that I'm able to be more present, but I catch myself when I'm not present. It's there'll be times when it's like, oh, wait a minute, I'm not here. It's like I'll be driving and I'll be going over some mental to-do list. And it's like, oh. And it's like, oh, not only do I recognize that I'm not driving and I really don't know how I got to where I am right now, but that if I would just pay attention to driving, that's a perfectly wonderful thing to do. Today, I went to the chiropractor, and he does this thing. He puts electrodes on my shoulder, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing. It's like a really complicated jacuzzi on your back. But I caught myself doing the same thing. It was like, here's this 12 minutes of this weird pleasure. And it's like, if I remember to be there, it's totally cool. But for a portion of that, I wasn't. And then it was like, oh, no, look, let's move. And I came back. And I do that a lot more often.
So simply being here for your life is something that develops.
I ended up with the mic, so maybe I'll share something. I'm still fairly new to meditation. I started meditating daily about 6 months ago, and I really have seen the beauty of it because I turned to meditation kind of out of desperation. I was having a lot of worry about my job. I had more responsibility than I was used to or could really handle, so I was having a really bad worry pattern going where I just couldn't stop worrying about what I was doing at work and whether things were going to work out okay or not. And I kind of turned to meditation out of desperation to try to get a handle on that. And it really has, you know, helped me amazingly. It's really saved me. Something that I had read, I can't even remember where now, as I was starting to meditate, helped me that certain bodily sensations can be the precursor to thoughts. And I started to recognize that I would get a feeling of maybe a little bit of anxiety or just kind of energy before the worrying thought came. At first it was maybe simultaneous, but then as I got a little bit more awareness, I realized that if I could feel that feeling, a lot of times the thought didn't even have to come. And that was really the key to breaking that pattern, that I'd be focusing on my bodily sensations. And when that feeling would arise, I could smooth out the feeling, and then the thought never came. And so that was really the key to breaking that cycle. And I don't think I ever would have found that without a meditative awareness of what was going on in my body and mind. So I thought that it was kind of interesting that we think of emotions and thoughts as being completely a mental phenomenon, but a lot of times there are body feelings or sensations that can be a key to your whole.
Only in the West do we think that way. That's not the deal in India, for example. Body mind are not separate, and that's what the practice does point to. That's a very, very important realization you've had. Very important. And there's a whole practice develops around, if you're really plagued by something, there are actually specific practices that you can work with to help yourself around particularly afflictive things, panic attacks or worrying or whatever, by staying with those bodily emotions. That's a very important piece of it. Anyone else?
This is not something I feel like I've accomplished and I now have mastery over something, but I think in some of the talks that I've heard about motivations and also just witnessing in myself that when I make decisions out of grasping desire, seeing the outcome of that again and again and again, that when I approach decision making now, I'm working more and trying to be aware of what are the true motivations. I mean, what do I actually feel like I really want to do? Where are the different sort of impulses and motivations coming from? And then sort of how else can I make that decision? Is there something that needs to happen for sort of thinking about other approaches or ways to making choices and really being truthful with myself about why I'm doing things, trying to.
So if I could summarize, aware of intentions, aware of the feelings, emotions, thoughts that are accompanying your process and maybe driving it in ways, trying to be aware of what it is that's actually driving this. Is it possibly greed or aversion, or is it something more informed than that? Yes.
Well, as we're talking tonight, I keep hearing the word practice, practice, practice. So to me, you know, it tells me that I don't have to be perfect. And there's, you know, talking about the patience and the compassion. And remembering that it's a practice. So that's one thing. And in my personal experience, what has really resonated with me most recently are a couple of talks, one last week on equanimity and another one a few weeks ago on impermanence. And when I sit in the mornings, these concepts come to me. And now a little bit more throughout the day where in an appropriate situation, I might go, oh, okay, now where's the equanimity to be able to handle this situation? And or noticing something that's so lovely and trying to attend to it in the moment because of the impermanence. So I also not only value the practice, but the messages that come with it as well.
That might go under category beautiful in the middle. I don't think there's probably anyone that does this practice because they're already perfect. What would be the point? I think people come to this practice because something's terribly wrong and they need to find some other way of going about their lives. And I've never heard anyone tell a story other than that kind of a story in its various multiplicity of forms. A couple of key points I'd like to make about this. I appreciate all of your responses. I think that this practice of watching yourself, well, first of all, I'd like to back up and say I became very aware of this issue with one of my grandchildren who is so other-directed. I mean, she is on stage from the moment she wakes up in the morning, and I began to realize this is, in fact, how we learn as children. We suck up everything going on outside of ourselves, and then we keep that program going pretty much out of force of habit until, for most of us, we get to be about 40 and we realize something wrong with this. It's not working very well. I don't know what's wrong, but it's not working very well. And what this practice does is it points to a radically different way of learning. You stop looking outside, you stop listening to the radio, stop listening to other people's opinions, and you start watching yourself. And you learn from what is actually known within yourself. And when you start doing that, you are a rank beginner. There is no way that you can know how to do this. And there's no way that we can really, in a way, tell each other how to do it. You have to learn it for yourself with some kind of general guidelines that can be offered by other people. And as you begin to do this practice, these relationships with yourself, like compassion and patience, arise. And I like to say, in a way, you fall in love with yourself in the same way that you become in love with anything that you devote attention to. A wonderful piece of music, or a piece of art, or your own wood carving, whatever it is. You develop a very different relationship to yourself by watching yourself. It's not a fatuous self-love. It's a love that's informed by learning and changing your relationship to yourself. It's very powerful. And it energizes the whole practice. Another very important thing is this idea of what mindfulness is. Now, we've already mentioned things like intention and prosecution of the intention, patience, persistence, investigation, some kind of reflective process in which you begin, this has been referred to by a number of you, which you begin to sort of figure out, oh yeah, when this happens, that's usually preceded by this or followed by this, as this gentleman talking about in terms of his worrying. Oh yeah. Yeah, every time I start to get upset, I actually can feel it in my body before my mind starts to take off on its self-righteous story about why this guy is always messing with me. I mean, you can start to, and the body tells you way ahead of the mind. And sometimes it's the other way around. The mind gets going and the body reacts to that with terrible physical suffering. But you begin to learn these things about yourself. That requires a quality of investigation, a quality of reflection, a quality of not just being here in the moment all the time, but also in some way cataloging all of these experiences, having a diary, building a repertoire of understanding about yourself. So there's some kind of a stocking process going on where you track all this stuff. So there's that quality that's got to be happening in mindfulness. There's another quality which isn't addressed very directly, but I use the phrase here a couple of times, open, receptive awareness. Now, to be receptive and open and aware of what is actually going on is something that we don't just automatically do. We have to develop that quality, because what it requires is no opinion going in. If you're going to really see what's happening, you can't already have your agenda in place. Your mind can't be running its opinions on you while you're watching something. You will never see what is happening. You will only see it through the veil of your opinions. So it requires the ability to step out of all of those mental proliferations and simply be open to what is actually happening without the overlay of interpretation, emotional reactivity to it, because a lot of things trigger those things in us constantly. And so you develop this ability to actually be in a neutral, aware place, not controlling, not opinionated, or not being, if you have opinions, being able to put them aside, not running your mind, not judging, not wanting, not reacting, running away from. All of those qualities have to be there for you to really be aware. Otherwise, you're conning yourself by one of these filters. So we learn that ability in chunks of microseconds. You know, we have a little bit of it, and then it's gone again, and then the mind comes flooding back, and then we learn it again. But we also begin to learn what it feels like to be, what it feels like in our body and our mind to be in that place as compared to the place that's filled up with opinions and thoughts and all of that stuff. And so we begin to recognize what it feels like to be in that place, how much more open and receptive we are when we are in that place, how much less burdensome life is when we're in that place, even if it's for little teeny drib-drabs of time at a time in the beginning. And there's a quality of being alive and being fully in the moment that can only be attained with those kinds of qualities. And it's good stuff. I mean, does anybody here doubt that that's a better place to be than having your mind all wrapped around some particular afflictive emotion right now? I mean, we know it's good stuff. And you learn it a little bit at a time. And that's, to me, one of this beautiful in the beginning thing. You get a peek at that just in little moments, even at the beginning. There's something about this process of starting to differentiate between the thinking mind and the aware mind that is critical. The thinking mind is never here now. Thinking mind is always in the past or the future. It is never here. Now, the thinking mind is important. It's a valuable thing, so I'm not putting a knock on that. But if you're trying to understand what's actually happening now, the thinking mind is totally in the way. There's this other quality of mind, the aware mind, that you have to build a muscle for in this practice. And the aware mind will tell you what is actually going on. The thinking mind is deluded almost all the time with all kinds of a vast library of opinions and judgments and concepts about the age of the universe and all this stuff that we don't actually know anything about in our personal experience. And what this practice is devoting itself to is our experience. I'm not knocking cosmology. I'm just saying, if we're trying to learn about what is happening here now, cosmology is not any help. And so leave it at home. I mean, the conceptual mind, whatever its favorite places that it loves to run in, and I've got mine, is not very helpful in this practice. The concept of impermanence is not helpful. it's a place to start. We all intellectually know about impermanence, right? Anybody think that everything's permanent out there? Okay, so we intellectually know about impermanence. Is everybody totally okay with the fact that you're going to die? So you intellectually know about impermanence, but you don't really know about impermanence. There's some way that we're still holding. I mean, you may die, but I'm not going to. I mean, there's some way we're holding that away from ourselves. The real understanding, the really getting it about impermanence. So what this practice is pointing to is that if you have to have the experience over and over again of impermanence. You have to actually feel it in your bones, not think about it. And the practice is showing you a way to do that. Pay attention to the emotions that are arising in your body now, the feelings, the thoughts. Pay attention to those. They'll show you what the truth of life is. The fact that it is absolutely impermanent. And it's full of suffering, unavoidable suffering. But you can create a relationship to the suffering that makes it totally manageable rather than terrible. And this self thing, we're making it all up. And you begin to see that through your own experience, seeing how you yourself have created yourself. And you've done a crappy job. I mean, not you. I'm not pointing my finger here. I've done a crappy job. We've all done a crappy job. I mean, it's just not meant to be a very skillful place to be, sitting here in this self-created identity. It just doesn't work very well. And it hasn't worked for thousands of years. And yet we're still doing it. It's in our bones. But we can see in this practice the glimpses of, oh yeah, that's another story I keep making up about myself. And it doesn't serve me. And I just made it up about my inadequacies or whatever the stories are I've made up about myself. I probably was 3 years old when I made it up and I'm sticking to it. I mean, that's really unwise. But to really decondition ourselves from all of these conditioned personality traits that we think we own permanently, we have to do it a little teeny bit at a time. And so it's this persistent effort at practice gives you the, every now and then, another one of those little insights that says, oh yeah, here's this one again. And the compassion is critical. For myself, the thing that hooked me on this practice at the very outset was the first night of teaching I got from a guy who actually had never done the practice, but he read a book about it. But the thing that he said right away was, when you find yourself lost in thought, just come back to the breath. No self-criticism. I happened to be at that point in my life totally trapped in self-criticism. And I thought, wow, you know, if this practice doesn't have anything else in it, that I can actually practice non-self-criticism 5 or 10 times a minute for every time I sit down. I mean, that's enough for me. That's what got me started. Just that practice alone. Just every time I do something that's not perfect, not what I wanted to have happen, don't go there. Just don't go there. And what you start to see is that the mind is such a pathetic creature of habit. so uncreative, so unimaginative, that you can actually con it into giving up its habits. You can actually tell it not to do self-criticism, and after a while, it doesn't remember to do it anymore. Or not to worry. And after a while, it gets off of that. It doesn't mean it becomes enlightened. It may go on to something else that you wish it hadn't. But, you know, then you work on that one. And there are going to be lots of others in there. Once you uncover that main one, the one that you're really obsessed with, underneath that is, oh, this is really ugly. But, you know, the fact is you can work your way down through all that stuff. You can actually change the landscape of your mind by simply not indulging in its habits, but offering it some other things instead. And it's all just built out of these basic tools that you start assembling as you simply sit down and try and do it. And nobody's any good at it when they start. You've never done it before. How could you possibly be good at it? And yet our critical mind says, oh, I can't do this. This is way too hard. I mean, everybody else in the room is doing it, but I'm not doing it. There's that comparing mind all the time. Everybody else in the room, everybody's always smarter than I am. Everybody's always, you know, whatever. Just try it. Just don't worry about whether you're any good at it or not. Just do it. And the mind will begin to respond to these new lessons. Just starting up from these very small things, in the same way that a kid starts to learn how to walk or the alphabet or whatever it is. It's the same kind of building process. It's a little at a time. And we can all do it. In that spirit, I would like to close with a guided meditation, if people are amenable to that. Are there people in the room who've never had been shown something called metta practice, loving kindness practice? So, in the spirit of replacing unskillful mental habits with skillful ones, in addition to the mindfulness practice, this practice we've been talking about up till now tonight, there are a series of practices in Buddhism which have to do with deliberately cultivating skillful habits of mind. And there are four of them. Loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And so, here's my hope in doing this practice. Every time that your mind used to say, oh, you idiot, it now says, it's all right, you're wonderful. Imagine if your mind said that every time. It's okay. You did your best. Everything's fine. Instead of, oh, you idiot, you did it again. So, this practice is meant to begin to engender an inclination of mind to go there rather than that old place that brought all that suffering. Whatever that old place is, I just made up one, but we've all got ours. So what you actually do is deliberately cultivate the mind-body posture that engenders the arising of loving-kindness. So here is a brief, my version of this. And everyone needs to come up with their own. So it's something that's yours, that it resonates for you. But I'll give you the general idea. So, close your eyes and be comfortable. And bring to mind someone that you really have a lot of affection for, care a lot about. It can be anyone, your spouse, parent, child, mentor, friend. And we're going to extend loving kindness to that person by wishing them well. So holding that person who's very dear to you in your heart, mind, wish them well in whatever ways you feel would be most useful. May you be well, healthy, strong. May you be safe from all harm. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you care for yourself with joy. May you be well and strong. May you be safe from all harm. May you be happy and at peace and care for yourself with joy. Now, maintaining that same feeling of caring, loving, hold yourself in your mind's eye and wish yourself well. Sometimes that's difficult, but I'm encouraging you to hold yourself the way you have just held your dearest loved one. May I be happy. May I be healthy and strong. May I be safe from all harm. May I be at peace. May I care for myself with joy. When you first do this, there's a feeling perhaps of a kind of hollowness about this practice, but you will find if you do it, you develop the same abilities to bring a genuine caring to this practice, not only for your best friend, but for yourself. And then you enlarge the practice by turning now to someone neutral. Could be an individual is neutral, could be everyone in this room. People with whom you don't have any particular relationship that's positive or negative. But bring that same energy of caring, of genuinely offering them what you want so much for yourself and for all of your loved ones. May everyone be well and strong. May everyone be safe from all harm. May everyone be happy and at peace. May everyone care for themselves with joy. Now stretch yourself a little more. Bring to mind a difficult character. Maybe someone that you are in a close relationship with. It may be somebody at work, down the street, in the White House, wherever. And bring that same energy, knowing full well that if they could be what you're wishing for them, it would be better. The world would be a better place. So holding that difficult person in your mind's eye, wish them well. Wish them health. And strength. And safety. And happiness and peace. And the ability to care for themselves with joy. Thank you all very much.